and called it ours, Bull said. That's like saying I've got to borrow your truck, but since I ran it into a ditch and hauled it back out, it's mine now. Law is a many-splendored thing, Bull, Fred said. He sounded tired. Something else was bothering him. Bull opened another drawer, threw half his socks into the recycler, and put the others on his t-shirts. Just if the judge doesn't see it that way, could be awkward, Bull said. The judges on Earth don't have jurisdiction, Fred said, and the ones in our court system are loyal to the OPA. They know the big picture. They're not going to take our biggest ship off the board and hand it back over. Worst case, they'll order compensation. Can we afford that? Not right now, no, Fred said. Bull snorted out a little laugh. Ever wonder what we did wrong that got us here? You're driving one of the biggest desks in the OPA, and I'm XO to Ashford. That ain't a sign we've been living our lives right, man. About that, Fred said. We've had a little change of plan. Bull opened his closet, his lips pressing thin. Fred hadn't just come to chew the fat. There was a problem. Bull took two suits out of the closet, both still wrapped in sticky preservative film. He hadn't worn either one in years. They probably didn't fit. Ashford thought it would be better to have Michio Pa as the XO. We've talked about it. I'm reassigning you as chief security officer. Third in command now, Bull said. What? Ashford think I was going to frag him and take his chair? Fred leaned forward, his fingers laced. The gravity of his expression said he knew it was a crap situation, but was making the best of it. It's all about how it looks, Fred said. This is the OPA's navy. The behemoth is the belt's answer to Mars's and Earth's heaviest hitters. Having an Earther on the bridge doesn't send the right message. All right, Bull said. I'm in the same position. You know that. Even after all this time, I have to work twice as hard to command loyalty and respect because of where I'm from. Even the ones who like having me around because they think I make Earth look weak don't want to take orders from me. I've had to earn and re-earn every scrap of respect. Okay, Bull said. Security officer was going to mean less time in uniform. With a sigh, he put both suits on the chair. I'm not saying that you haven't, Fred said. No one knows better than I do that you're the best of the best. There are just some constraints we have to live with. To get the job done. Bull leaned against the wall, his arms crossed. Fred looked up at him from under frost-colored brows. Sir, I've been flying with you for a long time, Bull said. If you need to ask me something, you can just do it. I need you to make this work, Fred said. What's going on out there is the most important thing in the system, and we don't know what it is. If we embarrass ourselves or give the inner planets some critical advantage, we stand to lose a lot of ground. Ashford and Pa are good people, but they're belters. They don't have the same experience working with Earth forces that you and I do. You think they're going to start something? No. Ashford will try his hardest to do the right thing, but he'll react like a belter and be surprised when other people don't. Ashford has only ever done a right thing because he's afraid of being embarrassed. He's a pretty uniform surrounding vacuum, and you can't rely on that. I'm not, Fred agreed. I'm sending you out there because I trust you to make it work. But you're not giving me command. But I'm not giving you command. How about a raise? Not that either, Fred said. Well, heck, Bull said. All the responsibility and none of the power? How can I turn down an offer like that? No joking, We're screwing you over, and the reasons are all optics and political bullshit. But I need you to take it. So? I'll take it, Bull said. For a moment, the only sound was the quiet ticking of the air recycler. Bull turned back to the task of putting his life in a footlocker again. Somewhere far above him, hidden by tons of steel and ceramic, raw stone and vacuum, Behemoth waited. Chapter 3. Melba. When she walked into the gambling house, Melba felt eyes on her. The room was lit by the displays on the game decks, pink and blue and gold. Most of them were themed around sex or violence or both. Press a button, spend your money, and watch the girls put foreign and offensive objects inside themselves while you waited to see whether you'd won. Slot machines, poker, real-time lotteries. The men who played them exuded an atmosphere of stupidity, desperation, and an almost tangible hatred of women. Darling, an immensely fat man said from behind the counter. Don't know where you think you come to, but you come in the wrong place. Maybe best you walk back out. I have an appointment, she said. Travin. The fat man's eyes widened under their thick lids. Someone in the gloom called out a vulgarity meant to unease her. It did, but she didn't let it show. Travin in the back, you want him, darling, the fat man said, nodding. At the far end of the room, through the gauntlet of leers and threat, a red metal door. All of her instincts came from before, when she was Clarissa, and so they were all wrong now. From the time she'd been old enough to walk, she'd been trained in self-defense, but it had all been anti-kidnapping. How to attract the attention of the authorities, how to de-escalate situations with her captors. There had been other work, of course. Physical training had been part of it, but the goal had always been to break away, to run, to find help. Now that there was no one to help her, nothing quite applied. But it was what she had, so it was what she used. Melba, not Clarissa, Melba nodded to the fat man and walked through the close-packed, dim room. The full gravity of Earth pulled on her like an illness. On one of the gambling decks, a cartoon woman was being sexually assaulted by three small, gray aliens while a flying saucer floated above them. Someone had won a minor jackpot. Melba looked away. Behind her, an unseen man laughed, and she felt the skin at the back of her neck tighten. Of all her siblings, she had most enjoyed the physical training. When it ended, she began studying Tai Chi with the self-defense instructor. Then, when she was 14, her father had made a joke about it at a family gathering. How learning to fight might make sense, he could respect that, but dancing while pretending to fight looked stupid and wasted time. She'd never trained again. That was 10 years ago. She opened the red door and walked through it. The office seemed almost bright. A small desk with a built-in display tuned to a cheap accounting system. White, frosted glass that let in the sunlight but hid the streets of Baltimore. A formed plastic couch upholstered with the corporate logo of a cheap brand of beer that even people on Basic could afford. Two hulking men sat on the couch. One had implanted sunglasses that made him look like an insect. The other wore a t-shirt that strained at his steroidal shoulders. She'd seen them before. Travin was at the desk, leaning his thigh against it. His hair was cut close to the scalp, a dusting of white at the temples. His beard was hardly longer. He wore what passed for a good suit in his circles. Father wouldn't have worn it as a costume. Ah, look! The inimitable Melba. You knew I was here, she said. There were no chairs. No place to sit that wasn't already occupied. She stood. Course I did, Traven said. Soon as you came off the street. Are we doing business? She asked. Her voice cut the air. Traven grinned. His teeth were uncorrected and gray at the gums. It was an affectation of wealth, a statement that he was so powerful mere cosmesis was beneath him. She felt a hot rush of scorn. He was like an old cargo cultist, imitating the empty displays of power and no idea what they really meant. She was reduced to dealing with him, but at least she had the grace to be embarrassed by it. It's all done, miss, Traven said. Melba Alzbeta Co. Born on Luna to Alci, Becca, and Sergio Co. All deceased. No siblings. No taxation indenture. Licensed electrochemical technician. Your new self awaits, huh? And the contract? The Cerisier ships out. Civilian support for the grand mission to the ring. Our Miss Co. She's on it. Senior class, even. Little staff to oversee. Don't have to get your hands dirty. Traven pulled a white plastic envelope from his pocket. The shadow of a cheap hand terminal showed through the tissue. All here. All ready, he said. You take it and walk through the door a new woman, huh? Melba took her own hand terminal out of her pocket. It was smaller than the one in Traven's hand and better made. She'd miss it. She thumbed in her code, authorized the transfer, and slid it back in her pocket. All right, she said. The money's yours. I'll take delivery.
There is still one problem, Traven said.
We have an agreement, Melba said. I did my part.
And it speaks well of you, Traven said. But doing business with you? I enjoy it, I think. Exciting discoveries to be made. Creating this new you, we have to put the DNA in the tables. We have to scrub out doubled records. I think you haven't been entirely honest with me.
She swallowed, trying to loosen the knot in her throat. The insect-eyed man on the couch shifted, his weight making the couch squeak. My money spends, she said.
As it should, Traven said.
Clarissa Melpomene Mao, daughter to Jules Pierre Mao of Mao Kwiatkowski Mercantile.
Very interesting name.
Mao Kwiatkowski was nationalized when my father went to jail, Melba said. It doesn't exist anymore.
Corporate death sentence, Traven said as he put the envelope on the desk display. Very sad. But not for you, huh? Rich men, no money. They find ways to put it where little eyes can't find. Get it to their wives, maybe. Their daughters.
She crossed her arms, scowling. On the couch, the bodybuilder stifled a yawn. It might even have been genuine. She let the silence stretch, not because she wanted to pressure Traven to speak next, but because she didn't know what to say. He was right, of course. Daddy had taken care of all of them as best he could. He always had. Even the persecution of the United Nations couldn't reach everything. Clarissa had had enough money to live a quiet, retiring life on Luna or Mars and die of old age before the capital ran out. But she wasn't Clarissa anymore. And Melba's situation was different. I can give you another 10,000, she said. That's all I've got. Traven smiled his gray smile.
All that pretty money flown away, eh? And what takes you out into the darkness, eh? I wondered. So I looked. You are very, very good.
Even knowing to squint, I didn't see more than shadows. Didn't hear more than echoes. But he put the envelope on the desk before him, keeping one finger on it the way her brother Peter did
when he was almost sure of a chess move, but hadn't brought himself to commit. It was a gesture of ownership. I have something no one else does. I know to look at the ring. 10,000 is all I have. Honestly, I've spent the rest. Would you need more then? Travin asked. Investment capital, call it? Our little Melba can have 10,000 if you want it. 50,000 if you need it. But I will want more back. Much more. She felt her throat tighten. When she tilted her head, the movement felt too fast, too tight, bird-like, scared. What are you talking about? She asked, willing her voice to sound solid. Formless threat hung in the air like bad cologne, masculine and cheap. When he spoke again, false friendliness curved all of his vowels. Partners, you are doing something big. Something with the ring and the flotilla, huh? All these people heading out in the dark to face the monsters, and you are going with them. It seems to me that such a risk means you expect a very great return. The sort one expects from a Mao. You tell me what is your plan. I help you how I can help you. And what comes your way from this, we divide. No deal. The words were like a reflex. They came from her spine, the decision too obvious to require her brain. Travin pulled back the envelope, the plastic hissing against the table. The soft, tutting sound of tongue against teeth was as sympathetic as it was false. You have moved heaven and earth, he said. You have bribed, you have bought, you have arranged. And when you say that you have held nothing in reserve, I believe you. So, now you come to my table and tell me no deal? No deal is no deal. I paid you. I don't care. We are partners, full partners. Whatever you are getting from this, I am getting too. Or else there are other people, I think, who would be very interested to hear about what the infamous Mao have been so quietly doing. The two men on the couch were paying attention to her now. Their gazes were on her. She turned to look over her shoulder. The door to the gambler's den was metal, and it was locked. The window was wide. The security wire in it was the sort that retracted if you wanted the glass to open and let the filthy breeze of the city in to soil the air. The insect-eyed one stood up. Her implants were triggered by rubbing her tongue against the roof of her mouth, two circles, counterclockwise. It was a private movement, invisible, internal, oddly sensual. It was almost as easy as just thinking. The suite of manufactured glands tucked in her throat and head and abdomen squeezed their little bladders empty, pouring complex chemistry into her blood. She shuddered. It felt like orgasm without the pleasure. She could feel conscience and inhibition sliding away like bad dreams. She was fully awake and alive. All the sounds in the room, the roar of street traffic, the muffled cacophony of the gambling decks, Travin's nasty voice, went quieter, as if the cocktail flowing into her had stuffed foam in her ears. Her muscles grew tense and tight. The taste of copper filled her mouth. Time slowed. What to do? What to do? The thugs by the couch were the first threat. She moved over to them, gravity's oppressive grip forgotten. She kicked the bodybuilder in the kneecap as he rose, the little beer coaster of bone ripping free of its tendons and sliding up his thigh. His face was a cartoon of surprise and alarm. As he began to crumple, she lifted her other knee, driving it up into his descending larynx. She'd been aiming for his face. Throat just as good, she thought, as the cartilage collapsed against her knee. The insect-eyed one lunged for her, He moved quickly, his own body modified somehow. Fused muscular neurons, probably. Something to streamline the long, slow gap when the neurotransmitters floated across the synapses. Something to give him an edge when he was fighting some other thug. His hand fastened on her shoulder, wide, hard fingers grabbing at her. She turned in toward him, dropping to pull him down. Palm strike to the inside of the elbow to break his power, then both her hands around his wrist, bending it. None of her attacks were conscious or intentional. The movements came flowing out of a hindbrain that had been freed of restraint and given the time to plan its mayhem. It was no more a martial art than a crocodile taking down a water buffalo was. Just speed, strength, and a couple billion years of survival instinct unleashed. Her Tai Chi instructor would have looked away in embarrassment. The bodybuilder sloped down to the floor, blood pouring from his mouth. The insect-eyed man pulled away from her, which was the wrong thing to do. She hugged his locked joints close to her body and swung from her hips. He was bigger than she was, had lived in the gravity well all his life. He buffed up with steroids and his own cheap augmentations. She didn't need to be stronger than him, though. Just stronger than the little bones in his wrist and elbow. He broke, dropping to his knee. Melba, not Clarissa, swung around him, sliding her right arm around his neck, then locking it with the left, protecting her own head from the thrashing that was about to come. She didn't need to be stronger than him, just stronger than the soft arteries that carried blood to his brain. Trevin's gun fired, gouging a hole in the couch. The little puff of foam was like a sponge exploding. No time. She shrieked, pulling the power of the scream into her arms, her shoulders. She felt the insect-eyed man's neck snap. Trevin fired again. If he hit her, she'd die. She felt no fear, though. It had been locked away where she couldn't experience it. That would come soon. Very soon. It had to be done quickly. He should have tried for a third bullet. It was the smart thing. The wise one. He was neither smart nor wise. He did what his body told him to, and tried to get away. He was a monkey, and millions of years of evolution told him to flee from the predator. He didn't have time for another mistake. She felt another scream growing in her throat. Time skipped. Her fingers were wrapped around Travin's neck. She'd been driving his skull into the corner of his desk. There was blood and scalp adhering to it. She pushed again, but he was heavy. There was no force behind her blow. She dropped him, and he fell to the floor, moaning. Moaning. Alive, she thought. The fear was back now, and the first presentiment of nausea. He was still alive. He couldn't still be alive when the crash came. He'd had a gun. She had to find what had happened to it. With fingers quickly growing numb, she pulled the little pistol from under him. Partners, she said, and fired two rounds into his head. Even over the gambling decks, they had to have heard it. She forced herself to the metal door and checked the lock. It was bolted. Unless someone had a key or cut through it, she was all right. She could rest. They wouldn't call the police. She hoped they wouldn't call the police. She slid to the floor. Sweat poured down her face and she began shaking. It seemed unfair that she'd lose time during the glorious and redemptive violence and have to fight to stay conscious through the physiological crash that followed. But she couldn't afford to sleep. Not here. She hugged her knees to her chest, sobbing not because she felt sorrow or fear, but because it was what her flesh did when she was coming down. Someone was knocking at the door, but the sound was uncertain, tentative. Just a few minutes and she'd be not all right, not that, but good enough. Just a few minutes. This was why glandular modification had never taken root in the military culture. A squad of soldiers, without hesitation or doubt, so full of adrenaline they could tear their own muscles and not care, might win battles. But the same fighters, curled up and mewling for 5 minutes afterward, would lose them again. It was a failed technology, but not an unavailable one. Enough money, enough favors to call in, and enough men of science who had been cured of conscience. It was easy. The easiest part of her plan, really. Her sobs intensified, shifted. The vomiting started. She knew from experience that it wouldn't last long. Between retching, she watched the bodybuilder's chest heaving for air through his ruined throat, but he was already gone. The smell of blood and puke thickened the air. Melba caught her breath, wiping the back of her hand against her lips. Her sinuses ached, and she didn't know if it was from the retching or the false glands that lay in that tender flesh. It didn't matter. The knocking at the door was more desperate now. She could make out the voice of the fat man by the door. No more time. She took the plastic envelope and shoved it in her pocket. Melba Alzbeta Ko crawled out the window and dropped to the street. She stank. There was blood on her hands. She was trembling with every step. The dim sunlight hurt, and she used the shadows of her hands to hide from it. In this part of Baltimore, 1,000 people could see her and not have seen anything. The blanket of anonymity that the drug dealers and pimps and slavers arranged and enforced also protected her. She'd be okay. She'd made it. The last tool was in place, and all she had to do was get to her hotel, drink something to put her electrolytes back in balance, and sleep a little. And then, in a few days, report for duty on the Cerisier, and begin her long journey out to the edge of the solar system. Holding her spine straight, walking down the street, avoiding people's eyes, the dozen blocks to her room seemed longer. But she would do it. She would do whatever had to be done. She had been Clarissa Melpomene Mao. Her family had controlled the fates of cities, colonies, and planets. And now, Father sat in an anonymous prison, barred from speaking with anyone besides his lawyer, living out his days in disgrace. Her mother lived in a private compound on Luna, slowly medicating herself to death. The siblings, the ones that were still alive, had scattered to whatever shelter they could find from the hatred of two worlds. Once, her family's name had been written in starlight and blood, and now they'd been made to seem like villains. They'd been destroyed. She could make it right, though. It hadn't been easy, and it wouldn't be now. Some nights, the sacrifices felt almost unbearable, but she would do it. She could make them all see the injustice in what James Holden had done to her family. She would expose him, humiliate him, and then she would destroy him. Chapter 4. Anna. Anushka Volovodov, Pastor Anna to her congregation on Europa, or Reverend Dr. Volovodov to people she didn't like, was sitting in the high-backed leather chair in her office when the wife-beater arrived. Nicholas, she said, trying to put as much warmth into her voice as she could manage. Thank you for taking the time. Nick, he said, then sat on one of the metal chairs in front of her desk. The metal chairs were lower than her own, which gave the room a vaguely courtroom-like setting, with her in the position of judge. It was why she never sat behind the desk when meeting with one of her parishioners. There was a comfortable couch along the back wall that was much better for personal conversations and counseling. But every now and then, the air of authority the big chair and heavy desk gave her was useful. Like now. "Nick," she said, then pressed her fingertips together and rested her chin upon them. "Sophia came to see me this morning." Nick shrugged, looking away like a schoolboy caught cheating on an exam. He was a tall man, with a narrow, raw-boned look outer planets types got from hard physical labor. Anna knew he worked in surface construction. Here on Europa, that meant long days in a heavy vacuum suit. The people who did that job were as tough as nails. Nick had the attitude of a man who knew how he looked to others and used his air of physical competence to intimidate. Anna smiled at him. "It won't work on me." "She wouldn't tell me what happened at first," she said. "It took a while to get her to lift her shirt. I didn't need to see the bruises. I knew they'd be there. But I did need pictures." When she said pictures, he leaned forward, his eyes narrowing and shifting from side to side. He probably thought it made him look tough, threatening. Instead, it made him look like a rodent. "She fell," he started. "In the kitchen," Anna finished for him. "I know, she told me. And then she cried for a very long time. And then she told me you'd started hitting her again. Do you remember what I said would happen if you hit her again?" Nick shifted in his chair, his long legs bouncing in front of him with nervous energy, his large, bony hands squeezing each other until the knuckles turned white. He wouldn't look directly at her. "I didn't mean to," he said. "It just happened. I could try the counseling again, I guess." Anna cleared her throat, and when he looked at her, she stared back until his legs stopped bouncing. "No, too late. We gave you the anger counseling. The church paid for you to go right up until you quit. We did that part. That part is done." His expression went hard. "Gonna give me one of those Jesus speeches? I am sick right up to here." Nick held his hand under his chin. "With that shit. Sophia won't shut up about it. Pastor Anna says, you know what? Fuck what Pastor fucking Anna says." "No," Anna said. "No Jesus speeches. We're done with that too." "Then what are we doing here?" "Do you," she said, drawing the words out, "remember what I said would happen if you hit her again?" He shrugged again, then pushed up out of the chair and walked away, putting his back to her. While pretending to stare at one of the diplomas hanging on the wall, he said, "Why should I give a fuck what you say, Pastor Anna?" Anna breathed a quiet sigh of relief. Preparing for this meeting, she'd been unsure if she'd actually be able to do what was needed. She had a strong, visceral dislike of dishonesty, and she was about to destroy someone by lying. Or, if not lying, at least deceit. She justified it to herself by believing that the real purpose was to save someone. But she knew that wouldn't be enough. She'd pay for what she was about to do for a long time in sleepless nights and second-guessing. At least his anger would make it easy in the short term. Anna offered a quick prayer. "Please help me save Sophia from this man who's going to kill her if I don't stop him." "I said," Anna continued at Nick's back, "that I would make sure you went to jail for it." Nick turned around at that, a rodent's low cunning back on his face.
"Oh yeah?"
"Yes." He moved toward her in the low-gravity version of a saunter. It was intended to look threatening. But to Anna, who'd grown up down the well on Earth, It just looked silly. She suppressed a laugh. Sophia won't say shit, Nick said, walking up to her desk to stare down at her. She knows better. She fell down in the kitchen, and she'll say it to the magistrates. That's true, Anna said, then opened the drawer of her desk and took the taser out. She held it in her lap where Nick couldn't see it. She's terrified of you, but I'm not. I don't care about you at all anymore. Is that right? Nick said, leaning forward, trying to frighten her by pushing into her personal space. Anna leaned toward him. But Sophia is a member of this congregation, and she is my friend. Her children play with my daughter. I love them. And if I don't do something, you're going to kill her. Like what? I'm going to call the police and tell them you threatened me. She reached for her desk terminal with her left hand. It was a gesture meant to provoke. She might as well have said, "Stop me." He gave her a feral grin and grabbed her arm, squeezing the bones in her wrist together hard enough to ache, hard enough to bruise. She pointed the taser at him with her other hand. "What's that?" "Thank you," she said, "for making this easier." She shot him, and he drifted to the ground, spasming. She felt a faint echo of the shock through his hand on her arm. It made her hair stand up. She pulled up her desk terminal and called Sophia. "Sophia, honey, this is Pastor Anna. Please listen to me. The police are going to be coming to your house soon to ask about Nick. You need to show them the bruises. You need to tell them what happened. Nick will already be in jail. You'll be safe. But Nick confronted me when I asked him about what happened to you. And if you want to keep us both safe, you need to be honest with them." After a few minutes of coaxing, she finally got Sophia to say she would talk to the police when they came. Nick was starting to move his arms and legs feebly. "Don't move," Anna said to him. "We're almost done here." She called the new Dolinsk Police Department. The Earth Corporation that had once had the contract was gone, but there still seemed to be police in the tunnels, so someone had picked it up. Maybe a Belter company, or the OPA itself. It didn't matter. "Hello. My name is Reverend Dr. Anushka Volovedov. I'm the pastor at St. John's United. I'm calling to report an assault on my person. A man named Nicholas Trubachev tried to attack me when I confronted him about beating his wife. No, he didn't hurt me. Just a few bruises on my wrist. I had a taser in my desk and used it before he could do anything worse. Yes, I'd be happy to give a statement when you arrive. Thank you." "Bitch," Nick spat, trying to get off the floor on shaky limbs. Anna shot him again. "Tough day?" Nono asked when Anna finally got home. Nono was dandling their daughter on her lap, and little Nami gave a squeal and reached for Anna as soon as she closed the door behind her. "How's my girl?" Anna said, and dropped onto the couch next to them with a long sigh. Nono handed the baby to her, and Nami immediately set about undoing Anna's bun and trying to pull her hair. Anna squeezed her daughter and took a long sniff off the top of her head. The subtle and powerful scent Nami had given off when they'd first brought her home had faded, but a faint trace of it was still there. Scientists might claim that humans lacked the ability to interact at the pheromonal level, but Anna knew that was baloney. Whatever chemicals Nami had been pumping out as a newborn were the most powerful drug Anna had ever experienced. It made her want to have another child, just to smell it again. "Namono, no hair pulling," Nono said, trying to untwist Anna's long red hair from the baby's fist. "Don't want to talk about it?" she said to Anna. Nono's full name was Namono too, but she'd been Nono ever since her older twin had been able to speak. When Anna and Nono named their daughter after her, the name had somehow morphed into Nami. Most people probably had no idea the baby was named after one of her mothers. Eventually, yes, Anna said, but I need baby time first. She kissed Nami on her pug nose. The same broad, flat nose as Nono, just below Anna's own bright green eyes. She had Nono's coffee-colored skin, but Anna's sharp chin. Anna could sit and stare at Nami for hours at a time, drinking in the astonishing melding of herself and the woman she loved. The experience was so powerful, it bordered on the sacred. Nami stuck a lock of Anna's hair in her mouth, and Anna gently pulled it back out again, then blew a raspberry at her. "No eating the hair," she said, and Nami laughed as though this was the funniest thing ever spoken. Nono took Anna's hand and held it tightly. They didn't move for a long time. Nono was cooking mushrooms and rice. She put some reconstituted onion in with it, and the strong scent filled the kitchen. Anna cut up apples at the table for a salad. The apples were small and not very crisp, not good for munching, but they'd be fine in a Waldorf with enough other flavors and textures to hide their imperfections. And they were lucky to have them at all. The fruit was part of the first harvest to come off of Ganymede since the troubles there. Anna didn't like to think how hungry everyone would be without that moon's remarkable recovery. "Nami will be asleep for at least another hour," Nono said. "Are you ready to talk about your day?" "I hurt someone, and I lied to the police today," Anna said. She pushed too hard on the knife, and it slipped through the soft apple and scored her thumb. It wasn't deep enough to bleed. "Well, okay, you'll have to explain that," Nono said, stirring a small bowl of broth into her rice and mushroom mix. "No, I really can't. Some of what I know was told in confidence. This lie you told, it was to help someone." "I think so. I hope so," Anna said, putting the last bits of apple in the bowl, then adding nuts and raisins. She stirred in the dressing. Nono stopped and turned to stare at her. "What will you do if you get caught in the lie?" "Apologize," Anna said. Nono nodded, then turned back to the pot of rice. "I turned on your desk terminal today to check my mail. You were still logged in. There was a message from the United Nations about the Secretary General's Humanitarian Committee project. All those people who they're sending out to the ring." Anna felt a sharp twist of guilt, of having been caught out at something. "Shit," she said. She didn't like profanity, but some occasions demanded it. "I haven't responded yet." It felt like another lie. "Were we going to talk about it before you decided?" "Of course, Nami is almost 2, Nono said. "We've been here 2 years. At some point, deciding to stay is deciding who Nami is going to be for the rest of her life. She has family in Russia and Uganda who've never seen her. If she stays here much longer, they never will." Nami was being fed the same drug cocktail all newborns in the outer planets received. It encouraged bone growth and fought off the worst of the effects low-gravity environments had on childhood development. But Nono was right. If they stayed much longer, Nami would begin to develop the long, thin frame that came with life out there. To life in low gravity. Anna would be sentencing her to a life outside her home world forever. "Europa was always supposed to be temporary," Anna said. "It was a good posting. I speak Russian. The congregation here is small and fragile." Nono turned off the stove and came to sit by her, holding her hand on the table. For the first time, the faux wood tabletop looked cheap to Anna, tacky. She saw with startling clarity a future in which Nami never lived anywhere with real wood. It felt like a punch to the stomach. I'm not mad at you for coming here, Nono said. This was our dream, coming to places like this. But when you asked for the transfer out here, you were 3 months pregnant. I was so unlikely to be chosen, Anna said, and she could hear the defensiveness in her own voice. Nono nodded. But you were chosen. And this thing for the UN, flying out to the ring as part of the Secretary General's advisory group, and our baby not even 2. I think 200 people signed up for the same slot, Anna said. They chose you. They want you to go. It was so unlikely, Anna started. They always choose you, Nono interrupted, because you are very special. Everyone can see it. I can see it. I saw it the first time I met you, giving your speech at the Faith Conference in Uganda. So nervous you dropped your notes, but I could have heard a pin drop in that auditorium. You couldn't help but shine. I stole you from your country, Anna said. It was what she always said when Nono brought up how they met. The Ugandan church could have used a young minister like you. I stole you, Nono said, like she always said. Only this time it had a disconcertingly pro forma feel. As though it were an annoying ritual to be rushed through. But you always say this. There were so many others, I was so unlikely to be picked. It's true. It's the excuse you use. You've always been one to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. I won't go, Anna said, pushing her hand against her eyes and the tears that threatened there. Her elbow banged into the salad bowl, nearly knocking it off the table. I haven't said yes to them. I'll tell them it was a mistake. Anushka, Nono said, squeezing her hand. You will go, but I'm taking Nami back to Moscow with me. She can meet her grandparents, grow up in real gravity. Anna felt a white-hot spike of fear shoot through her stomach. You're leaving me? Nono's smile was a mix of exasperation and love. No, you're leaving us, for a little while. And when you come back, we'll be waiting for you in Moscow, your family. I will find us a nice place to live there, and Nami and I will make it a home, a place where we can be happy. But we will not go with you. Why? Was all Anna could think to say. Nono got up and took 2 plates out of the cupboard, then dished up dinner and put it on the table. As she spooned Waldorf salad onto her plate, she said, I'm very afraid of that thing, the thing from Venus. I'm afraid of what it will mean for everything we care about. Humanity, God, our place in his universe. I'm afraid of what it will do, of course, but much more afraid of what it means. I am too, Anna said. It was the truth. In fact, it was part of the reason she'd asked to join the expedition when she heard it was being assembled. That same fear Nono was talking about. Anna wanted to look it in the eye, give God a chance to help her understand it. Only then could she help anyone else with it. So, go find the answers, Nono said. Your family will be waiting for you when you get back. Thank you, Anna said, a little awed by what Nono was offering her. I think, Nono said around a mouthful of mushrooms and rice, that maybe they will need people like you out there. Like me. People who don't ask permission. Chapter 5. Bull. It's not in the budget, Michio Pa, executive officer of the behemoth, said. If she'd been an Earther, she would have been a small woman. But a lifetime in microgravity had changed her the way it did all of them. Her arms, legs, and spine were all slightly elongated, not thin exactly, just put together differently. Her head was larger than it would have been, and walking in the mild 1/3 G thrust gravity, she stood as tall as Bull, but still seemed perversely childlike. It made him feel shorter than he was.
"We might need to adjust that," he said. "When they put in the rail gun, they were treating it like we had standard bulkheads and supports. Thing is, the Mormons were really trying to cut back on mass. They use a lot of ceramics and silicates where the metals usually go. Directional stuff. We fire a round right now, we could shear the skin off."
Pa walked down the long, curving corridor. The ceiling arched above her, white and easily twice as high as required, an aesthetic gesture by designers who hadn't known they were building a warship. Her stride a little wider than his, moving a little more comfortably in the low G and making him trot slightly to keep up. It was one of a thousand small ways Belters reminded Earthborn men and women that they didn't belong here. The XO shook her head. "We came out here with an operational plan," she said. "If we start rewriting it every time we find an adjustment we'd like to make, we might as well not have bothered." Privately, Bull thought the same thing, but with a different inflection. If he'd been XO, the operational plan would have been called a suggested guideline, and only opened when he wanted a good laugh. Pa probably knew that. They reached the transit ramp, a softly sloping curve that led from the command and control levels at the head of the behemoth down to the massive drum of her body, from Pa's domain to his. "Look," Pa said, her mouth twitching into a conciliatory smile. "I'll make a note of it for the refit, but I'm not going to start reallocating until I have an idea of the big picture. I mean, if I start pulling resources out of environmental control to cover this, and next week we find something that needs doing there, I'll just be pushing it back, right?" Bull looked down the ramp. Soft lights recessed in the walls filled the air with a shadowless glow, like a cheesy vision of heaven. Pa put her hand on his shoulder. She probably meant it to be sympathetic, but it felt like condescension.
"Yeah, okay," he said.
"It'll be all right, Chief," she said, giving his trapezius a little squeeze. He nodded and walked down the ramp to the transfer platform. Her footsteps vanished behind him, submerging in the hum of air recyclers. Bull fought the urge to spit. The behemoth, back when she'd been the Nauvoo, had been built with a different life in mind. Most ships built for travel between the planets were like massive buildings, one floor above another, with the thrust of the Epstein drive at the bottom, providing the feeling of weight for whole voyages, apart from a few hours in the middle when the ship flipped around to change from acceleration to slowing down. But Epstein or not, no ship could afford the power requirements or the heat generated by accelerating forever. Plus, Einstein had a thing or two to say about trying to move mass at relativistic speeds. The Nauvoo had been a generation ship, its journey measured in light years rather than light minutes. The percentage of its lifespan it could afford to spend under thrust was tiny by comparison. The command and control at the top of the ship, and the main engines and the associated parts of engineering at the bottom, could almost have belonged to a standard craft connected by a pair of kilometers-long shafts, one for a keel elevator to move people, and another that gave access to the skin of the drum. Everything else was built to spin. For the centuries out to Tau Ceti, the body of the Nauvoo was meant to turn. 10 levels of environmental engineering, crew quarters, temples, schools, wastewater treatment, machine shops and forges, and, at the center, the vast interior. It would have been a piece of earth, curved back on itself. Soil and farmland and the illusion of open air, with a central core of fusion-driven light and heat as gentle and warm as a summer day. All the rooms and corridors in the body section, the vast majority of the ship, were built with that long, slow, endless season in mind. The brief periods of acceleration and deceleration at the journey's ends hardly mattered, except that they were all the ship had now. Those places that should have been floors were all walls, and would be forever. The vast reinforced decks meant to carry a tiny world's worth of soil were the sides of a nearly unusable well. Someone slipping from the connection where the command and control levels met the great chamber could fall for nearly 2 full kilometers. Water systems built to take advantage of spin gravity and Coriolis stood on their sides, useless. The Nauvoo had been a marvel of human optimism and engineering, a statement of faith in the twinned powers of God and rigorous engineering. The behemoth was a salvage job, with mass accelerators strapped to her side that would do more damage to herself than to an enemy. And Bull wasn't even allowed to fix the problems he knew about. He passed through the transfer station and down toward his office. The rooms and corridors here were all built aslant, waiting for the spin gravity that would never come. Stretches of bare metal and exposed ducting spoke of the rush to finish it, and then to salvage and remake it. Just walking past them left Bull depressed. Samara Rosenberg, longtime repair honcho on Tycho Station and now chief engineer on the behemoth, was waiting in the anteroom, talking with Bull's new deputy. Serge, his name was, and Bull wasn't sure what he thought of the man. Serge had been part of the OPA before that was a safe thing to be. He had the traditional split circle insignia tattooed on his neck and wore it proudly. But like the rest of the security force, he'd been recruited by Michio Pa, and Bull didn't know exactly how things stood. He didn't trust the man yet, and distrust kept him from thinking all that well of him. Sam, on the other hand, he liked. "Hey, Bull," she said as he dropped onto the foam core couch. "Did you get a chance to talk to the XO?"
"We talked," Bull said. "What's the plan?" Sam said, folding her arms in a way that meant she already knew.
Bull ran a hand through his hair. When he'd been younger, his hair had been soft. Now it was like he could feel each strand individually against his fingertips. He pulled out his hand terminal and scrolled through. There were 5 reports waiting, 3 routine security reports and 2 occasionals, an injury report and a larceny complaint. Nothing that couldn't wait.
"Hey, Serge," Bull said. "You hold the fort here for an hour?"
"Anything you want, Chief," Serge said with a grin.
It was probably just paranoia that left Bull hearing contempt in the words.
"All right, then. Come on, Sam, I'll buy you a drink."
In a coalition ship, back when there'd been an Earth-Mars coalition, there would have been a commissary. In the OPA, there was a bar and a couple mom-and-pop restaurants, along with a bare-bones keep-you-alive supply of pre-packed meals that anyone could get for the asking. The bar was in a wide space that might have been meant for a gymnasium or a ball court. Big enough for 100 people, but Bull hadn't seen it with more than a couple dozen. The lighting had been swapped out for blue and white LEDs set behind sand-textured plastic. The tables were flat black and magnetized to hold the bulbs of beer and liquor to them. Nothing was served in glasses.
"Cheche,"
the bartender called as Bull and Sam stepped through the door.
"Mergin, alles mesa, you?"
"Meya," Sam replied, as comfortable with the mishmash belter patois as Bull was with Spanish or English. It was her native tongue.
"What are you having?"
Bull asked as he slid into one of the booths. He liked the ones where he could see the door. It was an old habit.
"I'm on duty," she said, sitting across from him.
Bull leaned forward, catching the barkeep's eye, and held up 2 fingers.
"Lemonades," he said.
"Sasa,"
the barkeep replied,
lifting a fist in the equivalent of a nod. Bull sat back and looked at Sam. She was a pretty enough woman, cute with pixie-cut hair and a quick smile.